You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of April 6th, 2015. On this week's show, we'll talk about Wisconsin's upset victory over Kentucky and how the no longer undefeated Wildcats will be remembered. We'll also discuss the start of the baseball season and whether this is the year where everyone will ask whether this is the year that the Cubs will win the World Series. Finally, we'll be joined by Bob Christensen, a man who has written more than 20 sports television theme tunes, to ask where the inspiration comes from to compose something like... Stefan, you want to help me out here?
Da 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 da.
Joining me.
That's good. That's good.
Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak, A Few Seconds of Panic, and a cappella sports theme tune maestro. How are you, Stefan?
I'm well.
I don't know if you guys noticed, we got spam to the hangup at slate.com account from Stavros Firmos, which I think is now going to be Stefan's alter ego. Like, if you have a particularly strong take on something, that's going to be Stavros Firmos.
Oh, I thought it would be more like when he's a little irrelevant and off topic and something we don't want to hear. It would be like, you're Stavros Firmrosing it.
It's a very versatile spam pseudonym. I think we can just have fun with it.
How do you know it wasn't me spamming you?
We're through the looking glass.
Because there were no references to Scrabble.
With us from New York is Mike Pesca, host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist, with Mike Pesca. Yeah.
Mike, what's your spam? What's your spam name?
Mikos Peskos.
We're all Greek. And spam.
All spam names are Greek.
Yeah.
How was Chicago?
It was good. I find the town to be, what's the word, Todlin.
What?
That Todlin town.
Oh.
You never heard about Chicago being a Todlin town?
I thought it was like T-O-D-L-I-N.
Do the listeners know what Mike Pesca was doing in Chicago?
I was hosting Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and looking askance at the mayor's race. I'm calling bullshit on the mayor's race.
If you were looking at
I was eating a sconce while looking askance.
All right, Stavros. Let's move along.
That's right, Firmrose.
In our bonus segment for Slate Plus members this week, we're going to check Polo off of the hang-up bingo card.
The hang-up bucket list.
We're going to be joined by a star of the U.S. Polo team. He's going to discuss the U.S.'s second place finish at the recent Polo World Championships. If you want to hear, if you want to check Polo off your personal hang-up and listen bingo card, you got to be a Slate Plus member. Sign up at slate.com/hangup+. Get access to this and other podcast bonus segments on Hang Up and the Gab Fests and other Slate podcasts. You can get a free 2-week trial. So if you're not sure about this whole Polo thing, you can get, you can try it out for a couple weeks. Slate.com/hangup+. Stefan's nodding.
Polo's worth trying. Slate Plus.
It's worth trying.
If I were
going
to sign up for Slate Plus, it would be the week that there was a Polo segment.
That's a ringing endorsement if I ever heard one. On Saturday nights in Indianapolis, Wisconsin outscored Kentucky 15-4 in the last 6 minutes to win the second of two national semifinals, 71-64. Set up Monday night's national championship game against Duke. The Badgers' upset victory ended Kentucky's season at 38-1, two games short of college basketball's first 40-0 season, stopping them from becoming the first men's team to end the season without a loss since the 1976 Indiana Hoosiers. We're recording this podcast on Monday morning before Wisconsin plays Duke, but the Badgers win and the Kentucky loss give us more than enough to talk about. This was in the same genre as the Kentucky Notre Dame game. Close, extremely well played, great game. You had one of the best offenses in modern history and the best defense in modern history if you go by KenPom, and the offense won out for Wisconsin, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I said on MSNBC that this was about heart and resilience, and I prefaced
it. But that was just for MSNBC.
What'd you say on NPR, though?
Yeah.
What'd you say on Fox?
On
that it was about
NPR,
the free market at work.
Yeah. On NPR, I said it was a clear reference to the later works of Carl Heisen. I think that it was. Like, this is what I want to get to. We could talk about all the schemes. We could talk about the fact that Wisconsin had a lot of tall guys who drew the Kentucky guys away from the basket, but also who can shoot it from the outside and can, you know, break down their man individually on the dribble. And we could talk about how Decker was shooting out of his head. Yet on this show, we always decry cliches. And yet I really do think that a bunch of other teams, Ole Miss took him to double overtime, and Georgia
was
playing
Texas
close.
Texas A&M that took him to double overtime.
Oh, Texas A&M took him to double overtime. Ole Miss had a shot at beating him. I really do think that, you know, it's not always true, and every time someone comes back, it's not necessarily a triumph of believing in yourself, but I really felt it in this game, you know? I don't know if we could prove it. I think it is true in college basketball that emotions are a huge part of the game, and I do think that other teams have been in this position and wilted, like psychologically a little bit wilted. Kentucky always believes in itself. You got to find a team that believes in itself maybe more than Kentucky. And when Wisconsin went down, didn't we all say this is the position we've seen and this is where Kentucky wins again, and this is why the people who aren't reading KenPom think they're perfect, but we know they're undefeated, but they still have this quality of being able to kind of psychologically, if not physically, crush the opponent. And I was unbelievably impressed with Wisconsin's psychology in that whole game.
Well, everyone has been just fascinated by this Wisconsin team in terms of, you know, how much fun they seem to be having. They're winning all the press conferences as well as the games. You know, it's not just Nigel Hayes and the stenographer, Kaminsky, Decker. They all just seem to really like each other and be having a good time. And it's nice when the cliches seem to manifest themselves on the court, because this is a team that's been playing together for a long time, seems to play in harmony, which is manifested in the fact that their points per possession is outrageous.
It's like 1.25 or something crazy.
Right. And this plays into the kind of trope that we've seen in college basketball over the last, you know, 10, however many years, the Calipari and Memphis and Kentucky eras, that you often see these games towards the end of the season where it's the hyper-talented, inexperienced, one-and-done team versus the more experienced, you know, been there before group. And I don't think you can come to any conclusions about which model is better and which one wins more often. We have examples either way. But Wisconsin's the rare team that has a huge amount of talent. Like Decker and Kaminsky are both top 15 picks and has been together for a long time. It's not like the Wichita State model of guys who've played together for a while and maybe are not quite as talented.
Level. Right, yeah. Right, right. And but I think Mike has a point, though. I thought in the last 6 minutes of that game when Kentucky missed, what was it, 9 shots in a row, I did feel like emotional changes. And I did look at the Kentucky players on the bench and did see heads hung and Calipari looking kind of freaked out. Didn't the New York Times do a piece a couple months ago, a few months ago, about facial expressions and how NBA teams are analyzing the facial expressions of college players and weighing that as part of their draft strategies? I mean, I think there is something to this, the notion of emotional swings in sports and being able to read the emotional content of an athlete as he's performing to get clues as to how things are going. And I thought we clearly saw that toward the end of the game.
Well, Kentucky in 2012, if I'm remembering right, when they won the title, Calipari's first and only, had a huge lead against Kansas and kind of sat on the lead and just stalled the ball and just almost blew the game. And Nate Silver had an analysis of that in 538, talking about once Kentucky got their 4-point lead, they just kind of stopped playing the way that they had all game. And it's similar to how Notre Dame lost the game against Kentucky, where you do something that's working all game, you get the lead, and you're like, well, we've got to change now because we have the lead. We're going to take more time off the clock. We're going to play more one-on-one and have, whether it's Jaren Grant or, you know, one of the Harrison twins break down the defense one-on-one. I don't know if that sends a message to your team that, okay, we're going to go away from what's been working all game now, because this is now the time to
Strategies do change over the course of the game, but in this case, what happened was as the shot clock wound down, they kind of panicked. They didn't get good shots because of Wisconsin's great defense, because Wisconsin packs the middle and protects the arc too.
You're kind of playing into Wisconsin's strength and
correct.
Kentucky's weakness.
And then I think after the first shot clock violation, that had to have affected the mentality of the players. And after the second one, I think you could say, oh, they're screwed now. I mean, they were so panicked during those three possessions as the shot clock was about to run out.
Well, it wasn't just that they got bad shots. It's those three possessions where they got essentially no shot and shot clock violations. And that is so unbelievably impressive. And this year, Nate Silver, writing in 538, pointed out that, you know, Coach Cal blew it was the name of his headline. It was all about milking the clock and a reduction in offensive efficiency. But I would say Nate and I would both agree, for instance, that teams should go 2-for-1 with 50 something seconds left in the half. No team did it. Even, you know, you watch the praise for Tom Izzo, the praise for Bo Ryan. Neither of his teams went 2-for-1. It's just a fundamental thing. And I know in college ball, you play, 30 games and there's only one half as opposed to pro ball, 80 games with, you know, 4 quarters. But I never see college teams going 2-for-1. So that is a coaching, quote unquote, mistake. But the reason they don't do it is this is the way there is a benefit to consistency, especially with younger players. And I think that could defend Calipari a little bit. Look, they've won the games using this method. Have they won it using this wrong method? I mean, it's nice to know what you're going to do. It's nice to know that we're going to do the sit on the lead strategy. And by the way, if they had stopped Wisconsin, it was working up to a point. Yeah, they got really bad shots on a bunch of possessions, but they also didn't get stops on the other.
What Nate determined was that by reducing their own offensive efficiency, even by a little bit, it reduced their chances of winning the game by a lot more. And I think was the point of Nate's article.
Well, Aaron Harrison also had won them all those games in the NCAA tournament last year with these crazy bailout, end of shot clock, end of game shots. And so, in a game this close, you can just nitpick and point to, for example, the refs making that really bad call on what should have been a shot clock violation for Wisconsin.
It's all about shot clock violations.
A basket that tied the game. So we can, talk about coaching decisions, refereeing decisions, all of them had an effect. And we can choose to parcel out the amount of blame as we desire.
And then you know what else had an effect? The fact that they only look at replay under 2 minutes and that with 2:35. God damn it, I hate that rule. You know what I'm talking about? The shot clock violation that they blew is what I'm talking about.
So with this Kentucky team, one thing that interests me,
We can talk about them in a second.
But what interests me with this Kentucky team is how hard it is to remember these individual Calipari coached teams, even a couple years later, because of the amount of roster turnover. And a 40-0 season would have given this team a kind of immortality, where we would say, like, okay, that was the Towns, Colley Stein, Harrison Twins, Ulis Booker team.
I think
I'm not going to be able to rattle off those names like I just did in a year or two. And I can't, it's hard to remember which team was the one with Brandon Knight, which was the one with Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. You know, the teams of one generation ago, like we all know who was on the UNLV team, you know, 20 years later, you can say Stacey Augmon, Larry Johnson, Anderson Hunt, Greg Anthony. It's just interesting to me that this was going to be a historic, all-time great, unprecedented team. And then in a few years, we won't be able to remember even who was on it.
We should force these kids to stay in college so that we remember their names. They should defer their million-dollar paydays for our memories.
That's all I'm saying.
That's all Josh is saying.
What do you think of Duke, Mike, since we have to talk about them? This Justice Winslow. I'm interested in the Winslow-Sam Decker clutch-off.
I already can't remember who's on Duke.
I can't believe how good they are. I remember when they lost Suleiman. They didn't lose him. They kicked him off the team for horrible behavior. I said, well, they're done. I mean, okay. I didn't watch a ton of college basketball. I did watch them against St. John's. They seemed to struggle for a second and a half option. It seemed like without Suleiman, they would be done. And they just get better. A lot of Duke teams do get better as the year goes on. And I do, you know, I defer to Las Vegas, who says it's a pick'em game. But in the history of these things where a team pulls off something monumental in semifinals, you always have the discussion beforehand. Was that their national championship? As far as I can remember, guys, think of a counterexample. The team that does the monumental semifinal upset rolls. You know, the 1980 Olympic hockey team, 1991 Duke UNLV. Sample set of two.
There has been
talk Kansas of Duke in 1988.
I read that talk this morning. Can we mention one thing here? Nigel Hayes, stenographer, funny, ha-ha, prestidigitation, cattywampus. He's also a plaintiff in a lawsuit that has been filed against the NCAA by noted labor lawyer Jeff Kessler from New York, seeking to create a free market for college athletes. He signed on to this lawsuit, obviously, while he was still an undergraduate. They've had to replace the plaintiffs because they need active athletes. There's a football player from Middle Tennessee and a football player from Clemson who've agreed to do this. And I think that demonstrates a tremendous amount of courage, frankly, on his part. Forced Wisconsin to issue a statement defending the NCAA, but also defending his right to free speech and behavior. He's been asked about this very little during the tournament. The Washington Post has a long piece this morning in which they questioned some of the basketball players about whether they deserve to be paid, and they didn't ask Nigel Hayes. So there's not a lot of recognition here. So this guy actually has, I think, some tremendous, you know, great, seems like he has a great personality and great character, but he also has demonstrated some real, you know, moral thoughts and ideas here and being willing to.
Well, Taylor Branch in his Atlantic cover story mentioned I don't think he proved it out, but the claim rumor that a team about 20 years ago threatened to almost walked out of a game before the Final Four to protest the whole NCAA thing. So, you know, come on, Nigel. Show some gumption now. He didn't say what team it was.
Maybe his words will be like antitrust, restraint of trade.
Yeah.
At his next press conference.
Yeah. Well, I guess Shabazz Napier after the championship game last year.
Right after the championship game.
Mentioned not being able to eat. So maybe Nigel Hayes will have a nice post-game speech if Wisconsin does win.
Wait, but he turned it into the Hungry Huskies. Will they be the what Badgers?
The
Barrister Badgers.
The Barrister Badgers because they're suing. Very good.
On Sunday night at Wrigley Field, fans reportedly resorted to peeing in plastic cups because there were only two working bathrooms on the main stadium concourse due to ongoing stadium renovations. A reader also reported to Deadspin that the concession stands ran out of everything but French fries. But for Cubs fans craving a sense of normalcy as the 2015 Major League Baseball season began, at least they got to witness a season-opening loss to the St. Louis Cardinals. If everything else was going wrong at Wrigley Field, at least the product on the field was about normal for Cubs fans. But one game is only one game. It seems plausible that Cubs fans won't have to wait till next year to urinate or to see their team in the World Series. Over the weekend, ESPN's Buster Olney wrote a fictional account of the Cubs winning the title for the first time since 1908. First baseman Anthony Rizzo squeezing the final throw from Starlin Castro. The Sporting News, too, has predicted that the Cubs will win the World Series, and the Sporting News exists. That's important to note. Though the odds makers prefer the Washington Nationals with their formidable starting rotation. Two different team-building strategies there. The Nationals have they signed Max Scherzer in the offseason. They have what seems like the best starting rotation in the game. The Cubs have rebuilt under Theo Epstein, the former Red Sox GM, building up their minor league system to one of the best, probably the best in the sport in the last few years. But that's the good thing about baseball, Mike, right? That you can have all these different strategies. You have the Padres trying to sign every player on earth. And we go into the season with many different teams of many different strategies, having hope for the new season.
It is both the good thing about baseball and I think the bad thing, though you could argue me out of my curmudgeonliness, but in this era when 88 wins gets you into the playoffs and the difference between 88 wins and 82 wins is 6 wins, but it's really kind of luck-based. Yeah, do something to try to get in the postseason and then win a championship because, you know, we know about baseball not being a high-variance sport and therefore a lot of randomness happens in the postseason. I don't know. Hope does spring eternal, and yet it also springs random. And I know this is popular, and I know that fans of the Padres and Mariners and Cubs have reason to hope, and that's good, but it does seem that the structure of the game is a little bit weird and much different from football, basketball, hockey, all the other sports where they either play a lot of games or each game kind of does come down to the team that's played better in the game.
That's what I love about this sport. And I'm frankly not so up in traditional arms over the fact that 88 wins get you in the playoffs and maybe gets you to the World Series. And maybe, like last year, both teams get to the World Series with, what was it, 88 or 89 or fewer wins. You know, we are so accustomed to talking about trends in baseball, you know, from particularly starting with Billy Beane and Oakland more than a decade ago now. And the trend that we are in now is how do you adjust to an era in which pitching has become so dominant and the technology and science of pitching has become so sophisticated that teams have been able to create pitchers, more of them, that can throw extremely hard for longer periods during the game in which batters don't have time to adjust. Tom Verducci has a nice piece in Sports Illustrated this past week examining this phenomenon. And the description I really liked was that pitching has changed so much that effectively batters have less time to determine what kind of a pitch is coming. For the first 30 feet after a ball is thrown, it looks the same, whether it's a two-seam fastball or a four-seam fastball or a cutter. And that reduces the time. So batters have no way to change the way they behave. And that's why we're in such a pitching-dominated era. Is that a bad thing, Josh? Is that an okay thing? Or is that just another cyclical change in this sport?
Well, I think that it's perfectly fine from a fan enjoyment perspective. It doesn't necessarily bother me that there aren't as many home runs. And I don't think it particularly bothers fans of teams so long as their team is winning. Baseball is such a local sport, and I think the reason that fans go out to the ballpark is to see a team that's competitive and that wins games, not necessarily a team that, you know, scores a lot of runs or hits a lot of home runs. But what I think is interesting is how this reality, this trend, manifests itself in terms of team building strategy. And you have the Nats, who have built this kind of super rotation. And there was an interesting piece on Grantland, Rainey Gizerli, on whether it's overkill to put together a team that's this good, given the reality of 80-something wins getting you into the playoffs. Does it make economic sense to spend this money on a Scherzer when you already have a great rotation. But, you know, the economics of the game and the way that they influence team building, those have been like two of the bigger stories in the offseason. You have the Chris Bryant situation in Chicago, where he hits 9 home runs in spring training.
Power hitting third baseman, best prospect in the system, et cetera.
And they send him down and Epstein lies. Theo Epstein, the president of the Cubs, lies, saying we're sending him down for, you know, quote, the quote unquote baseball reasons, when they're doing it for cost control, because due to a collectively bargained agreement with the players, you know, you have to have a certain amount of service time to be a free agent. So it's in the Cubs' long-term interest, if not their short-term interest, to have this guy start in the minor leagues. Then they can keep his services for a year longer later in his career, when he's going to be this super talented player. And then you have the Angels with Josh Hamilton, a guy who makes more than $20 million a year, formerly great player, not so great anymore, relapse with alcohol and cocaine, and Major League Baseball is not suspending him for that. And the Angels are pissed. They're coming out and saying, how can you, these are like official statements, not like back channel anonymous quotes, yeah, saying we can't believe that he's not being suspended, because they want to save the money on his contract.
Yeah. It's not because they have a strong stance against drug and alcohol. They have a strong stance against paying a guy who resorted to drug and alcohol. This is why, by the way, I mean, the rule should just be you can't save the money.
No, they actually have, Mike, they actually have a strong stance against a guy whose production has declined so precipitously that he's not probably even worth keeping in their lineup, potentially. And this is an excuse.
Right.
I mean, it's the A-Rod argument.
Right.
The Yankees didn't want to pay A-Rod, and they argued against him, too.
Right. And all those suspensions should be the team should have to pay it to someone. But, you know, Cubs fans, actually, their interest should be aligned with Theo Epstein. It's not like Theo Epstein is screwing the Cubs. He's mortgaging the short term for the long term, and that's the wise thing
to
do.
And it's not even that much of a mortgage, is it? It's like 2 weeks that he has to stay in the minors before he'd be denied a full year of service.
Maybe a little bit longer.
Then they'll keep him a little longer, and just to, you know, make it seem that it's not quite so crass. But of course it is so crass. But in the that's the good thing about the 162 game season. You know, you could make up for that. This is the good thing about the 88 games will get you a wild card bid. You know, last year the Royals were this mediocre 500 team, then they went on a good run. So the Cubs, if they're as good as we think they are, will be fine even without KB, and then he'll be able to come up. I wonder, I'm very interested to see the Padres lineup. Is an interesting thing to me, because they've always had the worst offense because they play in this ridiculously big park. I mean, I like the fact that different ballparks have different dimensions, but this park's just too big, and it changes the game. The game's just different there than it is everywhere else. There are big parks, there are little parks, and there are Petco. And I kind of wonder what it's going to do. I'm always fascinated to see what it does to hitters beyond just, you know, make their production at home dip a little bit, or as much as the visiting.
Does it harm
players.
Them psychologically?
It does. I think it does. I think if you look at the road numbers of even like Adrian Gonzalez and a bunch of guys, well, maybe he's the one exception, but a bunch of guys, definitely the pitching numbers seem to do, pitchers do great in Petco, but then they kind of carry that momentum and do great on the road. So the Padres are really, okay, fine. I won't say it's bad. It's good. It's a big difference in park factor, and that's another charming quirk of baseball. Back to your point about, though, the pitcher, Stefan, you were saying that the pitchers are so much better, and the big thing is that batters have a slow reaction time. There's a bunch of things, and some of it's really smart. Like, curveballs are out, but spinning split fingers are in, or slurves are out, and cutters are in. They're realizing, and this is good, this is a triumph of intellect, they're realizing that having the ball move a lot isn't as important as having the batters be able to recognize the ball. So if a splitter, like Mariano Rivera, is the best in the game, it's not that it broke so much, it was that it was indistinguishable from a splitter that didn't break a lot. And so this makes it harder and harder on the pitchers. And then they talked about Koji Uehara's ball, which spins at some ridiculous rate of speed.
And 1,300 revolutions per minute or something.
Yeah, it was like 1,311 revolutions. Like, they can't, like, come on. You've got to be off by 4 or 5. But it's just fascinating stuff. And I had the inkling, was the steroid era suppressing this knowledge? Was it just like, oh, what's the point? These guys are so huge. We don't care. You can't even get into the subtleties of how much a ball is spun. I mean, baseball can be appreciated on so many levels. And this like very fine kinetic level, I think, is a fascinating aspect of the game.
So the question with that is, with the Tommy John surgeries, the numbers increasing as much as they are, is there not as much of an incentive for teams to keep individual pitchers healthy because they're able to create so much pitching talent and because pitching isn't particularly scarce in this pitching friendly era? And if that's so, then as an individual pitcher, how much do you think, or what should you do to know that, you know, you're just another cog for a team and you'll just be replaced by somebody else? Maybe you have to take more ownership of your health and your career and think that the team's not going to be looking out for you.
But it does seem that the corollary to the increase in velocity is the improvement in kinesiology, in the ability to protect and defend pitching arms from a younger age. The guy that Tom Verducci profiled in SI, Ron Wolforth, his entire training program is geared toward understanding release points, flexion points, the distance that the arm goes back, the elevation of the elbow before and after release. I mean, it's all about protecting the health of younger pitchers. And part of the reason I think that the mass of pitching has gotten better is because of these kinds of techniques. The outliers are the guys that get injured.
The guys who get injured are outliers?
Well, they're always outliers because more people are not getting injured than aren't. But yeah, there are more injuries, but we're also seeing, there are more of these catastrophic type injuries. But I think a lot of people believe that that has to do with the fact that that science had not caught up 5 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago. So as kids grew through their teen years and through college, that's when they were creating the damage that manifests itself in their early 20s, early to mid-20s.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. I think that it's they're throwing harder, and we're going to see. We're in this permanent era. Everyone's going to get hurt. I mean, Kershaw is going to get hurt. Sale's going to get hurt. And it's one of the things keeping the game from being popular. Hitters will play for years and years, but pitchers shelf life. I mean, I could read you all these past Cy Young Award, you know, first, second, third place guys are out of the game within 2 years. They weren't old. You know, Brandon Webb, they just had these injuries. It's going to happen over and over again. And
don't you also think that the science is going to get better and the medicine is going to get better so that we can predict and help prevent these kinds of injuries? Or is the emphasis on velocity so great?
I think the torque and the strain you put on the body, I mean, they could do some things to mitigate it. But, you know, all the teams, fine, pitch count is inexact, but I don't think you're going to find the perfect release point to stop the fact that your shoulder shouldn't be doing that as hard as that for as long.
All right, let's end the conversation there, having solved the pitcher injury problem. And
we'll solve the hitting problem another day.
We'll solve that another day. Let's move on to our last topic, which is if you've been watching the NCAA tournament for the last few weeks, you probably heard this a time or 60. The man who wrote that, which has been on the air since 1993, is Bob Christensen. In a piece last week on Slate, Eric Malinowski described him as the John Williams of TV sports theme composition, a man who, by his count, has written more than 24 sports theme tunes, including ones for the World Cup, the Super Bowl, and the Olympics, in addition to his work on TV shows like Game of Thrones and Sex and the City. Bob, it's great to have you.
It's good to be here.
So tell us about that CBS NCAA theme song, how it came to be, and whether you write for a particular sport. Are you thinking, like, I need a sports song, or are you thinking, I need a basketball tune?
Things have changed over the past 20 years. Sports themes used to be much more different from each other than they are now in terms of style. Back when I wrote the basketball theme, stylistically, CBS wanted something very different than football, very different than golf, you know, very different, obviously, from, like, the Masters. They wanted something really different. These stylistically, sports have become more homogenous these days, and you can, they're sort of interchangeable. But I wrote this back in about 1992 for a man named Doug Tuohy, who sadly is no longer with us, but he was one of the guys up at CBS who was sort of like the soul of CBS Sports. Great, great, great friend. And he liked my music, and anytime they needed a new theme, whether it be football or baseball or Ice Wars or whatever, they would Doug would decide between three or four or five composers who he would throw the job open to compete on. And I competed, probably against five other music houses. And he usually gave about a week to get it all together. And even back in those days, it was not just talking about piano demos. You would have to do like full up demo version of it with brass and the whole thing, just exactly how it would sound on television. So whenever I got these jobs, I tried to write as many as I could within the span of the time I had, as I'm sure all the other composers that were competing for it did, because we all wanted to win it. But it, at the end of the day, it comes down to whether, the guys up at CBS Sports happen to like the three or four notes or five notes or six notes that comprise the motif of your theme that repeated itself during, the piece. And if that caught their attention and everybody agreed on it, then you got the gig.
So what are you going for with from sport to sport? How does it differ in terms of like mood, emotion, content, scoring, arrangement? I mean, how do you sort of decide? Is it just a jingle pops into your head, or are you thinking basketball deserves this, whereas hockey gets that, or soccer needs this?
It's usually not any of those above. It used to be, like I said, it used to be more of a differentiation. Like you would never do, really, really hard rock for basketball. That was reserved for football and hockey. Nor would you do really hard rock for golf. But that's changed. Fox came along and sort of changed all that by using, heavy, a guitar-centric rock on everything. So there's much less of a differentiation in orchestration. Personally, I like hearing different styles for different sports. Basketball seems to be more rhythmic, more R&B, more up, more faster than, let's say, football, which is more gladiator, much, a little bit slower. That would, to me, have much more heavy guitars and that kind of stuff. But that's just me. When we first did the theme, not the version that they're using now, but the first time I wrote it and arranged it, I actually had the sound of a basketball in with the rhythm track. So as I did when I wrote the NHL theme for ESPN and ABC, I actually went up to Buffalo and recorded a whole bunch of hockey sounds that happened during the game, and put those in the rhythm track, so it became part of the whole groove. But it all comes down to the theme.
Did they stay in, or did they strip them out in the final?
In the original, they stayed in.
Yeah.
In the original, they stayed in, both for ABC and ESPN, which it's funny. I actually got the gig to do both of them at the same time. And this was right after, since there is no ABC Sports anymore, it's basically ESPN doing, all the production for them. And I had to come up with two different themes, but it was great, and I got to use the sounds for both of them.
I tend to think with things like your work, what we regard as the classics sometimes are because the work itself is good. Usually to become a classic song, it can't be bad, but it's often because it's just been going on for so long and is ingrained in our memories. But what do the experts think of as, let's say the gold standard, the Johnny's theme, the transcendent theme songs of the sports theme song genre?
Well, if you mention sports themes, the number one theme that people would probably say is one that I didn't write, which is ESPN Sports Center, only because that thing is on, 12 times a day, every day, and you hear the ba da 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 da.
I mean, is that good? Is that even good from a professional ear, or is that just familiar?
It's both. It's both good and bad. It's good because, it, like, for the NCAA, my team for the NCAA, the fact that they've been using it so long has become entwined with the sport. The theme and the sport have become one, and it's become real estate for them. It's become valuable to them, to which I am eternally grateful, believe me. You know, to have a theme being listened to by so many people and have that particular theme known by so many people is, you know, it's a wonderful thing.
There is something Pavlovian about it. Like, I can definitely...
Oh, yeah.
I can remember, like, well, you know, for this NCAA tournament, for example, when you hear those notes come on, you get excited, you know, just as you do when, you know, you see the opening tip. It gets you primed for the event in a way that's kind of unique in television, these sports themes and the way that they work on their brains. It's hard to think of something comparable.
Oh, absolutely. I was watching the news on CBS a couple of days ago, and one of the anchors on the morning show, the one between 7 and 9, they were talking about, you know, the Final Four and stuff like that, and the music came on, and one of the anchors said, oh, I love that music. And it, so you're right, it is Pavlovian. You hear those notes, you go, ah, basketball.
Or, ah, Carrie's going to get splashed by a bus, because you also wrote the Sex and the City theme song.
No, I didn't write the theme song. What I did is I did a lot of underscoring for the show. I did about between 65 and 70 pieces of music that they used from like the second through the sixth season.
Where do you stand on theme songs? The decline of theme songs, TV theme songs with lyrics. It's even crept into sports. I mean, there used to be many more songs with lyrics, and I guess now that Bocephus and Are You Ready for Some Football has been stripped, or All My Rowdy Friends Are Coming Around on Monday Night, whatever version of that he did. But are you an anti-lyrics to a theme song guy?
Not necessarily. I'm not particularly happy about is that the theme songs in particular for any shows, not just sports shows, but for any shows, have gone from a minute long to 45 seconds to 30 seconds to 10 seconds to now it's like 5 seconds. You know, if you watch The Blacklist, their theme is just a bunch of sound effects and a couple notes, you know, in the beginning. That's it. Boom. As compared to, let's say, House of Cards, which is a really great theme, and it goes on for...
It's a minute and actually 40 seconds, because after watching the first, like, 10 episodes of the show, you know exactly where to fast forward on to get to the start of the show. No offense to the theme song, everybody.
It's great that the producers and directors thought enough about the music to say, let's make a statement up here with the theme.
What influences do you think are especially important for sports theme music writers? I mean, is it NFL films of the 1960s and the sort of swelling orchestration to sort of dramatize particular moments? Or is it more, you know, jingle-based?
I think it's NFL films, but I think NFL films was probably what it comes down to is Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. I mean, that is the granddaddy of all sports themes, especially the way it was done by Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I mean, that groove and that ba 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 ba, you know, and the dun 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 dun. That the number of times I borrowed from that, let's say, is amazing.
$1 million idea for you, Bob. Bob Christensen performs his sports themes a cappella. It's really fun to hear you do. Can you do the MLB on CBS? We'll put in a clip here so people can hear it. But I also want to hear your rendition, because when I asked you what are some that you're most proud of, you mentioned this, you know, theme song for CBS Baseball from the 90s. So I'd like to hear your rendition of that one.
Well, that one I can remember. I hope I don't embarrass myself with the other ones. But the CBS, it was dun 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 ba da dun 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 dun.
People remember that one particularly fondly. In the piece by Eric Malinowski, you very modestly said, you know, it's just luck and who can say. But do you feel like you can articulate why that one or why any of your tunes resonates or is successful? Or is it really honestly just luck and voodoo?
Or do you know when you you've composed one that this one is going to stick?
You never do, and which is why I usually try to write, when I'm competing for a theme, I usually try to write at least four or five of them. What I try to do is one or two of them try to push the envelope of where I think they might want it to go, and then I'll do one or two where I think they would feel comfortable picking that particular style or that particular type of melody. And it's all over the place. Sometimes they'll pick something that's way out in left field, and sometimes they'll pick something that's comfortable. It really is luck. It's having what my friends might call the right earworm that will hit these people at the same time and go, yeah, that's it. That's what I want to hear. And it really does have nothing to do with anything except luck. I have done enough of these that I kind of know what works and what doesn't a good part of the time. Having said that, there have been quite a few competitions that I haven't won where I thought, wow, that was great stuff I wrote, but I just didn't get them at that particular day. If it was played for them another day, they might have picked it. It really does come down to dumb luck. It really does.
All right, final question for you. What do you think of One Shining Moment?
Oh, it's a great song. It's a great song. And I love the fact that they haven't done just one rendition of it, that they keep getting stars and keep doing different arrangements of it. And David's a wonderful writer. He's a friend. And that song has been as good to him as the NCAA theme has been to me. And we're both lucky.
Is there like a fraternity of sports theme show writers? Do you and John Colby, the guy that wrote the ESPN Sports Center theme, get together once in a while and just sort of sing at each other?
I'm embarrassed to say I've never met John. he had a studio in New York City for a long time, but no, we don't get together. We probably should.
All right, we'll broker that for another episode.
I think that could be that should be a documentary.
It could be. It should be.
Absolutely, that would be fun.
All right, Bob. Well, we appreciate you being here, and now everyone can think of you every time the NCAA tournament begins.
What should we do for an outro here? Which theme song do you think we should play, Bob?
Well, what do you got up there?
All right, I'm gonna play one from your sports reel, and you can tell us which one this is.
Oh, that's ESPN Weekly Golf.
Yeah, Weekly Golf. I'm feeling Weekly Golf. I feel like Curtis Strange, approach shot on 13. Oh, my God.
Now, if you listen to the championship golf, it's basically based on the same theme, but a totally different groove. It's much more orchestral. And then I had to do one for, I think it was the St. Andrews, something that they were broadcasting. And so I literally had to take that theme and do like a tattoo version of it with bagpipes and field drums and everything. So it was a lot of fun. Because bagpipes only play in one key, by the way. It's not like you can transpose them.
All right, Stefan is insisting that I play one more because we're having too much fun with this. All right, last one. Here we go.
That's ESPN Olympic Trials.
That feels very Olympics-y.
I can feel the agony and the thrill approaching.
Yeah. That we actually did with the real orchestra back in the days when we were using real orchestras. We recorded that in England, and that was about an 80-piece orchestra. It was a lot of fun. I went over there with Jed Drake from ESPN, and we had a lot of fun doing
it. All right, Bob, we're just going to call you back at just random intervals and play songs for you. This is too much fun. But thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Bob Christensen is a composer who has done the NCAA tournament theme for CBS, among more than 24 sports theme tunes. Now it's time for the After Balls. We're going to get to this in a minute in our bonus segment for the Slate Plusers, but this is too good to not bring to the whole audience. In polo, each of the innings, or however you want to term it, periods, quarters, whatever, is called a chucker. And that's not, you might be thinking, that's not that interesting. What if I told you that chucker was spelled with two K's? Have I changed your mind?
I also see a C-H-U-K-K-A spelling.
Well, that's even better.
I know. But you know what the other term I like from polo that I just found?
What's that?
Is for a polo pony, a made pony. It's like the ponies are in the mafia.
Oh, I thought it was more like in the shade.
Mike, what is your chucker?
Well, I would like to talk about the 30th anniversary of a great sports movie. Unfortunately, the movie came out in 86. So it's not the 30th anniversary, but here's the peg. The finals of the NCAA are in Indianapolis. And you know what else was in Indianapolis? The finals of the 1954 fictional Boys High School Championship. Off the record, I got to say that you guys are the best thing ever to happen to Indiana basketball. So I started showing my son 6 and 7 Hoosiers. I think the best sports movie ever, I would say Hoosiers, The Natural, and Rocky in that order. Maybe Rocky's not a sports movie. I haven't shown them The Natural yet. I've shown them Karate Kid, Rocky. Rocky has a couple of really inappropriate scenes for kids, but since every other scene plays really well for 6 and 7-year-olds, they will not get the fact that Paulie is upset that his sister's not a virgin anymore. Anyway, Hoosiers was so fantastic. My youngest son is on the couch bouncing up and down going, Hickory, Hickory, Hickory. Okay, what is the nickname of Hickory's team, guys? Do you remember?
Oh,
it is a state nickname, and it is alliterative.
Not the Hoosiers.
Not the Hoosiers.
No, it is a different state nickname.
Stumped.
Yeah, we're stumped.
The Huskers. They are the Hickory Huskers. And I've watched this movie many times. In fact, by the time I showed it to them, I probably watched it 10 times. And I knew some things that I will now share to the audience, but I learned some new things. One is that in the final game, every single shot is accounted for. So if you look at the scoreboard, they explicitly flash to the scoreboard at times. Every single shot. Now, sometimes there's just a montage of made basket, made basket, made basket, and you have to correctly assign who those go to. But the score is always reflective of something that shows up on screen. That, to me, is amazing. Another fact is that every flag in the movie is hung wrong. The field of blue, the field of blue is on the right-hand side, and it's supposed to be hung with the left. And I don't know why. I don't know if this was an Indiana thing, or it could be a mistake, because as I said, the movie's supposed to take place in 1954, but there is a map of the United States in one of the scenes, and Hawaii is in the map. Of course, Hawaii did not join the Union until 1959. But here is the new thing, because as I'm watching the movie, I kind of noticed that, do you guys remember the best player on the Hickory Huskers?
Jimmy Chitwood.
Yeah, Jimmy Chitwood. Now, you know, technically, Jimmy Chitwood doesn't have the third biggest part in the movie, or the fourth bit, right? You think of, I mean, best supporting actor nominee for an Oscar, Dennis Hopper, big role. And of course, as Coach Norman Dale, Hackman had a big role. And then the simmering love interest. This is the worst thing about the movie. The Barbara Hershey love interest, where they maybe held hands in barn coats. Okay, fine. She has the third or fourth.
I was going to ask if your kids demanded that you just fast forward to all the Barbara Hershey scenes. Like, get rid of this basketball.
Yeah. just the smoldering love tension between them. So
Hackman,
awesome.
Hershey.
I will now, but this is the thing. So Jimmy Chitwood had a pretty big role. He turns the movie around twice. He is the turning point of the movie, and he's almost a MacGuffin. I mean, he's there, but he's there all but symbolically. I don't know if it was the fact that the guy who played Jimmy Chitwood was just not a good actor. I kind of tend to think, and I'm going to buy the book on Hoosiers, maybe they'll sidestep this and not want to admit that he was a not great actor, but I think that it was symbolic. I mean, Gene Hackman has a huge scene with Maris Valenis where Valenis does not miss a shot, but he also doesn't speak a word. If you remember that scene where Gene Hackman tells him, I don't care if you don't play basketball, it's all Gene Hackman. And Valenis' contribution is just hitting every shot. Jimmy Chitwood doesn't miss. So here now are Jimmy Chitwood's entire, this is every line he says in the movie. I got something to say. It's about time for me to start playing ball again. Actually, it's more like I've been thinking about it. It's about time for me to start playing ball again. One more thing. Coach stays, I stay. Coach goes, I go. And I can make it. That's it. That's all Jimmy Chitwood says in the movie.
Boo Radley of Hoosiers.
But Boo Radley didn't decide to, you know, join on the defense team to win the case
for
Atticus.
Oh, but he very much did join on the defense of Scout.
Yes. So that's good. Okay. So he's the Boo Radley. We need to name a Radley-type MacGuffin for the Chitwood character. Two other facts that tell you a little bit about the real-life feel-good story of the guys who played them. One is the fact that one of the players on the team, the guy who says, you know, let's do this for all the small schools out there who never got a chance, he actually committed suicide when he was 39 years old, and he was a very good basketball player. And there's that part about where Barbara Hershey's character says, I don't want him playing basketball to be one of these guys who can only try to recapture his old glory. I thought of that when I thought about that story. The two other facts about some of the guys who played on the team, Brad Long, who played Buddy Walker, he played college basketball for Southwestern College. And I only mention that because Southwestern College, the Kansas Collegiate Athletic Conference champions of 1985 when he played, the Mound Builders. They're the Mound Builders. But another guy, Steve Holler, who played Reid Butcher, Steve Holler went to DePauw University, and there was a case about him being in this sports movie because they can't be paid for playing sports, obviously, the NCAA. And I think Steve Holler quite adequately, he said, I'm acting in a movie. I'm not playing sports. And I don't know if this is true, but it's been widely reported. It's on the Wikipedia page. I will just read this verbatim. This was the NCAA was very mad at Steve Holler for being in this movie as a basketball player. As penance, Holler was suspended for 3 games and required to give DePauw 5% of his movie earnings. Don't worry. It was Holler's first and last acting role. He is now a dentist in Warsaw, Indiana.
You know, a few years ago, Mike, the Harvard Sports Analysis Collective did an analysis of Hoosiers. Jimmy Chitwood, in the course of the movie,
yeah.
Jimmy was 20 for 23 from the field, 40 points, 2 assists, 3 steals. He accounted for 40 out of 90 points shown being scored by the Huskers.
Oh, yeah. I remember he didn't even play the first three games. So that actually, in terms of usage statistics, that actually seems spot on.
I think they came up with a net rating of 112 for Jimmy.
The other weird thing is that I love the movie. You love Normandale. Terrible coach. Like in real life, he'd be the guy that we just decried all the time for punching a kid and thinking the kids were in the military and not allowing any freedom of motion. God, he's everything we hate, and yet he's everything we love fictionalized.
All right, Stefan, what is your chucker?
Well, the most dominant team in college sports recruits a bench full of top-rated high schoolers. It sees some of its stars turn pro long before they get their mortarboard and tassel. Has a coach who unapologetically exploits the system and gets paid handsomely for the work. And I speak not of the University of Kentucky and John Calipari, but of the unstoppable chess team of Webster University in St. Louis and its coach, Susan Polgar, who last week did not lose the Final Four like Calipari's bunch. Instead, they won their third straight national championship, the President's Cup, which is better known as the Final Four of Chess. The Final Four of Chess isn't formally known as the Final Four of Chess because if it were, the NCAA's lawyers would be sending cease and desist letters by the dozen. But Polgar has built a Wooden-esque legacy in college chess while courting Calipari, Patino, Huggins-type controversy for program-building tactics that, just like in the NCAA, have triggered concerns about an arms race that is distorting the purpose and value of college extracurricular activities. Polgar is a chess grandmaster, 4-time women's world champion, one of the famous Hungarian-born glass chessboard-shattering Polgar sisters. In 2007, after retiring from competition, Polgar was hired by Texas Tech and formed the Susan Polgar Institute for Chess Excellence. That would be SPICE. Texas Tech was unranked at the time. In 2010, it won its first national championship. It repeated in 2011, knocking off perennial power, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, which had won a bunch of Final Fours in the earlier in the 2000s. But Polgar wasn't happy. She felt Texas Tech wasn't offering enough in the way of scholarships, salaries, and other resources. According to a story by Jason Fagone in Wired magazine in the summer of 2011, Polgar was invited to St. Louis by Division III Webster's Yugoslav-born chess-loving provost. St. Louis was emerging as a chess hotbed. Chess was proving to be a good recruiting and promotional tool for the few schools that were investing in it. Coincidentally or not, in late 2011, the Webster student newspaper reported Polgar gave Texas Tech a list of demands, including a $250,000 salary for her, $150,000 salary for her husband, who is also a one-time chess prodigy and coach, and funding for 34 full and partial scholarships, a tenfold increase in tuition funding. The total package amounted to more than $1 million annually. Texas Tech went on to win another Final Four, but the university rejected Polgar's demands, so she packed up her spice and moved to Webster. Eight of Polgar's Texas Tech players transferred with her. They didn't have to sit out a year, as they would have in NCAA basketball or football. Webster won the Final Four in 2013 and 2014, and last week in New York in the round-robin tournament, Webster crushed. It beat UMBC 3.5-1/2, the University of Texas Dallas 3.5-1/2, and Polgar's former team, Texas Tech, 3-1. Webster's 10-point total was a Final Four record. How has Polgar managed to five-peat? It's all about recruiting. Webster's lineup is like Kentucky's. The Gorlocks can send one wave after another of grandmasters to the board. This year's team had 8 grandmasters from around the world. Only 6 can compete in the Final Four, so a bunch of them had to be benched. Plus, the Webster roster has even more masters on their way to grandmasterhood. Polgar's kind of like Nick Saban or Gino Auriemma. She's stockpiling talent, just maybe, to keep it from other schools. And like Calipari preparing his players for the NBA draft, Polgar says her chess players come to her for pre-professional training, and they leave when they're ready. Filipino-born Wesley So came to Webster in the fall of 2012, ranked in the top 100 in the world. After 2 years on campus, he left to turn pro last fall, ranked in the top 10. Like her basketball and football coaching counterparts, Polgar talks a lot about commitment to academics, which is probably substantially easier to accomplish with chess geniuses than with Rivals.com prospects. No doubt another big recruiting tool is Webster's mascot, Mike, the Gorlock. Do you know about the Gorlock? Mythical creature with the paws of a cheetah, the horns of a buffalo, and the face of a Saint Bernard. It's named for the intersection of two streets on campus. Students came up with it in a contest way back when.
Let's go Gorlocks.
Go Gorlocks. Josh, what's your chucker?
Wesley So is now competing for the U.S.
USA.
USA. USA. It doesn't feel like that long ago, but it's now been 9 years since the release of The Blind Side, the book. Doesn't feel like it was 9 years ago.
No.
It's actually...
We like our 29th and 19th anniversaries here.
This is the 10th anniversary of The Blind Side. It's now been 6 years since the movie of the same name came out in theater, so also the 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. So round that up. The book and the movie told the story of a young black man named Michael Orr who was taken in by a rich white family, then went on to play in the NFL. The movie made more than $300 million worldwide. Sandra Bullock, Oscar. Millions were inspired.
She won an Oscar for that?
Wow. Yeah, she was sassy. She outsassed them all. Come on.
Millions inspired by this unique story of love and success forged across racial and economic lines. The Blind Side was not a unique story, Stefan. Back in 2010, I wrote a piece called The Other Blind Sides about how this same thing happened repeatedly in towns across America. The kids who are good at sports are often taken in by affluent families precisely because they're good at sports, that those kids are often black, the families are often white. For that piece, Michael Lewis told me that in hindsight, perhaps it wasn't his amazing journalistic acumen that led him to the story of The Blind Side, that maybe he stumbled onto it because it happens so often. This is not to criticize Michael Lewis. That book is great. It's as good as the movie is bad. But 5 years after I wrote the story, I decided to Google the phrase Blind Side story to confirm that indeed it is still happening. Perhaps the most famous example that's come up in the last 5 years since I wrote my piece is that of Chicago Bulls all-star Jimmy Butler, black basketball star taken in by white family. The Sandra Bullock role here is a woman named Michelle Lambert, who told ESPN.com that she had told Butler he had to stay out of trouble, work hard in school, he had to set an example, and you know what? Jimmy did it. Anything I asked him to do, he did it without asking questions. In that same story, Butler said they accepted me into their family, and it wasn't because of basketball. She was just very loving. She just did stuff like that. I could not believe it. There's LaKendrick Ross, described as the blindside story of the 2014 NFL supplemental draft.
Is that official? Is the NFL supplemental draft as an official blindside story?
It is, yeah. That's trademarked. He lived in 11 foster homes or group homes. He now plays on Dan Snyder's Washington football team. There's Isaza King, a high school football player in California who was taken in by the Brunk family after he made friends with their son. The best part about that piece by John Lindblom and the Record B of California is that it says King, quote, makes young girls coo like pigeons in a church belfry. That has nothing to do with anything, but I just like that. A recurring feature of the blindside genre is that the participants always deny that their story is anything like the blindside. A lot of people say it's another blindside story, said the coach who took in a Florida football player named Jaquan Johnson, but it's not that. I didn't go out and see some poor kid struggling on the side of the road I didn't know. This kid was just always part of my family, and we've loved him. From a New York Times story on football player Tajiddin Smith, this is not a blindside story. This is way deeper than that. And a piece on NFL player Jay Bromley. I did see the movie. Me being me, I wouldn't call my story as bad as the blindside. Even though I wasn't raised by my biological parents and lived in the hood, it wasn't always bad. I can't sit there and say that. I had some loving parents and sisters, the best they could, and I appreciated that.
Michael Orr also insists his story wasn't a blindside story, for the record.
It was way deeper. It merited a 700-page book.
Although he says he's never read the books.
But my favorite recent blindside story, which is not a blindside story, is that of Willie Cauley-Stein, the center for Kentucky. Cauley-Stein did not get along with his stepfather, so he moved in with his white grandparents in the small town of Spearville, Kansas. But that didn't work out either, so Cauley-Stein moved to Olathe, Kansas, where Will Shields, the black Kansas City Chiefs offensive lineman who was just elected to the Hall of Fame, became Cauley-Stein's legal guardian. So this is a double reverse, double blindside.
Wow.
So it's the basketball player taken in by a football offensive lineman. He also lives with the white grandparents, does the reverse and goes to live with the black family who's rich. This story is like completely turned the not a blindside story genre on its head for me. Stefan is Googling furiously right now to see if he can add something.
No, just I'm wondering why Olathe, Kansas.
And Willie Shields has recently been hired to run the Oakland A's front office in a
dramatic twist.
Yes.
We'd love your feedback on what we talked about
today. Willie Shields is now getting into speed trading.
You can email us.
Willie Shields is now destabilizing the economy of Iceland.
You can email us at hangupatslate.com to learn more about the Michael Lewis oeuvre. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe to Hang Up and listen on iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten.
I thought I saw Willie Shields hanging out with Jonah Hill recently. Did you see that, Mike?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Check out our entire roster of podcasts. It's Will, not Willie, at itunes.com/panoply. Our producer is Mike Volo.
Jonah calls him Willie.
Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. The executive producer Slate's podcast is Andy Bowers.
Will Shields just married an MTV VJ.
Members Elmo Beatty, thanks for listening.